keepers maintained the gardens and lawns that circled her tower like a moat. Dolores discovered, too, that she liked living around a lot of people. Her building and its conjoined 19-story twin, 1119 North Cleveland, together held 262 apartments and almost 1,000 residents. Towers of the same cross-hatched red brick faced her on all sides. "The more the merrier," Dolores would say. It was 19 floors of friendly, caring neighbors. Everyone watched out for each other. No gangs, drugs, or shootings. One of her sisters moved to a residential street on the west side, and it was so quiet, a cat slinking in the bushes would scare Dolores. "If everybody is laughing and happy or fighting, I know there's life out there," she'd say. All the families in the high-rises had gone through the same careful screening, and most of the households had two parents at home. People kept their doors unlocked and dropped by one another's apartments when they needed to borrow sugar or a cup of milk. They looked after one another's children. Dolores's next-door neighbors were Puerto Rican, and she got along with them great, even though the aromas of their cooking wafted onto the ramp. "I like garlic," she'd say, "but I don't like the smell of it." Dolores became close friends with a woman named Martha, who lived on the second floor, and had five children as well. And they'd go on outings together, sometimes bringing along another girlfriend from the building who also had five kids. They'd play in the large playground, or they'd walk to Seward Park or the Isham YMCA or to Pioneer Market, the three adults marching the 15 children. "We looked like a parade," Dolores said. In the mornings, thousands of people flushed out of the high-rises on their way to work. Many had jobs at Montgomery Ward, the giant retailer and mail-order cataloger, which was the neighborhood's largest employer. Oscar Meyer, an immigrant from Bavaria, had opened his business selling Old World sausages and Westphalia hams in Chicago in 1883, and 5 years later moved to the corner of Sedgwick and Division, just across Seward Park from Dolores's building. The eight-story plant produced hot dogs and sliced lunch meats. Dozens of other small factories near the river made everything from turtle wax and tamales to tractors, donuts, comic books, and children's toys. Industries lined the neighboring boulevards, producing paint, radios, elevator parts, billboards, and Dr. Scholl's shoes and arch supports. Others manufactured clothes, luggage, cameras, power plant equipment, picture frames, auto parts, and office supplies. A number of the Midwest's candy companies made their confections in the area, and Dolores and her children could taste the chocolate in the air. The neighborhood had an old settlement house, funded by the city's welfare council, called the Lower North Center, which had been housed in an 80-year-old building. When the Cabrini extension went up, it was rebuilt into a low-slung brick building the same color as the Reds, with classrooms, a nursery, meeting halls, and a gymnasium. CHA tenants used sewing machines there to learn dressmaking, and they went to the center to get coached for the civil service exam. Hubert held a number of different jobs, and quit a number of them, too. "Why are you home so early?" Dolores would ask him, knowing the answer. "I just walked out," he'd reply, explaining that they'd treated him unfairly. But the next morning he'd head out and land something new. One of their neighbors had walked into the Seaberg jukebox plant the same day he'd moved into his Cabrini apartment and was offered a position. "When do you want me to start?" he asked. "Right now," came the response. Only once, after Hubert had been laid off from a seasonal construction job, did the Wilsons consider going on welfare. But they thought that they'd be forced to give up their car and television and other belongings before they qualified. Instead, they borrowed a little money from Dolores's parents, just enough to get by, and Hubert soon found work again. Eventually, he was hired by the CHA as a janitor. He joined the brigade of custodians moving each day among the 15 Cabrini high-rises, hauling trash, cleaning hallways and stairwells, and straightening up anything that was in disarray. One of Dolores's new neighbors was also among Cabrini's most famous residents. Jerry Butler, the soul singer known as the Iceman, had been born in Sunflower County, Mississippi in 1939. And at three, his parents left sharecropping in the Delta for work in the war industries in Chicago. They settled into a tenement just a block from the Francis Cabrini row houses, the family living in a three-room basement apartment with no hot water that sat squarely within the area detailed in the CHA's Portrait of a Chicago Slum. The law now gave priority in the new high-rise public housing to families cleared from slum sites. And after the Butler's building was torn down to make way for the Cabrini Extension Towers, they moved into 1117 North Cleveland. While a student at Jenner, the local public school, Butler delivered newspapers on the Gold Coast, and at age 12, he had a job in a plastics company, operating an injection molding machine from 4 p.m. until midnight. As a teenager, he also stuffed mattresses at a nearby factory, and one of his co-workers took him to the West Side to sing at a basement ministry called the Traveling Souls Spiritualist Church. The minister was a mystic who said she'd communed with a spirit guide from among the dead. She also had a grandson, a pint-sized 9-year-old named Curtis Mayfield, who knew how to play the guitar and piano and who could sing in a high tenor that complemented the lower register of Butler's already silky baritone. The kids formed part of a quartet, the Northern Jubilee Gospel Singers, and began to tour spiritualist conventions. A couple of years later, Mayfield moved with his mother and siblings into a Cabrini row house on Hudson Avenue. With its front and backyard and private toilet, it was luxurious after the run-down hotel where they'd been staying. Jerry and Curtis knew of Ramsey Lewis, who had grown up in the Cabrini row houses and had already gone on to cut 2 records with his jazz trio. But they weren't into jazz. They sang doo-wop together outside the towers. They put on shows at the Lower North Center and practiced in the basement of Butler's high-rise and in a club room at the Seward Park Fieldhouse. By the benches in the park, a wino named Doug played an old guitar, producing a masterful sound, and the boys studied him for hours. Butler wanted to be a chef then, and he crossed Division Street, 2 blocks from his apartment, and signed up for culinary classes at Washburn Trade School. Many of the city's unions operated apprenticeship programs out of the high school, and professional chefs sometimes showed up to hire for their kitchens. When Butler started as a freshman, he was one of only a handful of black students. Then, as the school became fully integrated, the unions pulled their apprenticeships. Jerry sometimes bussed tables as well at his Uncle Johnny and Aunt Pearlie's restaurant next to Seward Park. Packed from morning through night with everyone from Irish cops and numbers runners to bus drivers, judges, and ministers, it was like a community roundtable for the ever-changing neighborhood. People his uncle knew from back home in Mississippi would make the journey up to Chicago, and he'd give them a job in the restaurant until they settled into something steadier. By then, Italians and African Americans had been living side by side in the area for decades, mostly peaceably, but sometimes not. In 1935, an Italian Property Owners Association took it upon itself to try to evict 4,700 black renters from the near North Side. Father Giambastiani of St. Benizi Parish defended the illegal acts. The landlords were protecting their property values as they had a right to do. Although the Sicilians he spoke for were manual laborers or shopkeepers, they'd come to the city and embraced the American dream of owning property. The rate of home ownership for first-generation Italians in Chicago was twice that of native-born whites. When the CHA was clearing the Little Hell slum in the 40s to make way for the Cabrini row houses, a group of Italians refused to sell. They didn't want to sacrifice personally for the government's notion of the greater civic good. Initially, the Cabrini row houses were to cover 55 acres, extending all the way from Chicago Avenue to Division Street. But the CHA had to scale the development back to 16 acres when it couldn't secure the land. The chairman of the CHA under Elizabeth Wood was an African-American architect and businessman named Robert Taylor. One of the few black officials in city government, he had helped found a savings and loan on the South Side, the rare banking establishment in Chicago to offer home loans to minority borrowers. He shared Woods' belief that the integration of public housing was a practical necessity as well as a moral one. A 250,000 Chicago families lacked safe and sanitary housing, with the greatest demand coming from the city's segregated black neighborhoods. Federal law dictated that new public housing developments couldn't change the existing racial makeup of a neighborhood, only match it. The CHA had at first avoided the trickiness of this neighborhood composition rule. Two New Deal-era sites inherited by the agency were on vacant land in all-white neighborhoods, and a third included a smattering of black families relegated to a corner of the complex with its own separate stairwell. When the Cabrini Row houses were completed, the surrounding area was 80% white and 20% black, and so the small development held to that quota. Black and Italian children played together in the parks and at the YMCA. They attended the same schools. Neighbors of different races joined up for block parties and the huge feast day celebrations of St. Dominic and St. Benizi. With an integrated project, we were all one big family, a white row house occupant recollected in When Public Housing Was Paradise. It was a real village. The Defender covered the opening of the row houses with uplifting images of middle-class domesticity. A black family of four enjoying a first meal in their dining room. Two Cabrini mothers, one white, one black, in similar blouses and long skirts, their shoulders touching as they gaze into an oven. The caption explains that they are joined for a child's 12th birthday and that the black mother is probably giving advice on how the birthday cake should be cooked. Or perhaps she is simply kibitzing, as the women will do. Father Giambastiani delivered a prayer at the Cabrini Row House's dedication. Within weeks, however, he was writing letters to Elizabeth Wood, complaining that the social experiment there had failed because blacks were being placed on the same level and house to house with the white people. This is being resented by all, and I must add, in order to be candid with you, that I don't like it either. Italian property owners lobbied the housing agency to segregate African-American renters to the southwest corner of the development, to preserve the character and values of the neighborhoods on the north side. Giambastiani began to advertise the parochial school of St. Benizi as an all-white alternative to the integrated Jenner. The neighborhood's two public parks set up separate hours for white and black children to use the facilities. Some in the community revived the terror of their parents' childhoods, calling themselves the Black Hand and attacking their neighbors. In April 1943, a group of whites shot into a Cabrini Row house occupied by a black family, and several hundred people took to the streets as fights broke out. During the next months, more police were stationed at Cabrini than at any other Chicago housing development, as city officials feared that the near north side might erupt into a full-fledged race riot. The Defender, hopeful, reported that amid the turmoil, 200 children at the row houses elected a 14-year-old black youth to head their junior government, the headline declaring, "White kids rebuff hate, elect Negro boy mayor." The neat columns of the Cabrini Row houses were bordered to the south by Chicago Avenue and to the west by Montgomery Ward's gargantuan 2-million-square-foot warehouse that curved where the Chicago River bowed. Directly to the east, several of the 7- and 10-story Cabrini high-rises were positioned like chess pieces on a single tract of land hardly bigger than a square block. Across Oak Street to the north, 19- and 10-story towers rose up like a wall. The Reds lined Larrabee heading north, and Division going west, and Cleveland heading back south to Oak, completing a four-sided bulwark that formed around the parkland between the buildings. Many row house residents saw the high-rises not as an extension of their community, but as something separate. The distinctions weren't merely design-related. By 1950, the population of the 25 blocks cleared to make way for the Cabrini Extension Towers had jumped to 80% black, as older Italians moved out and younger families moved in. The CHA touted one of the new Cabrini high-rises as its international building, reporting that some 262 Armenian, African American, Chinese, Danish, Eskimo, German, Indian, Italian, Irish, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Polish, Scottish, Swedish, and Turkish families live there in harmony, in friendship, and in peace. But overall, about 90% of the 1,900 families who moved into the 15 high-rises were African-American. The majority of them, like the Wilsons and the Butlers. Two-parent, working-class, and desperately in need of adequate housing. In Dolores's building, she knew of only one white family. The wife's name was also Dolores, and she used to sell her blood at Mount Sinai Hospital to make a little extra money. Unsettled by the shifting demographics, many white renters quit their row house apartments, with a great number of them moving to the western suburbs. "I saw the atmosphere go down in Cabrini," said a white mother who lived in the row homes with her family until the first high-rises opened. "I saw it change from sort of an ideal little community into a place that you wanted to get out of." The CHA no longer gave war workers or veterans preference in the developments, and the agency felt compelled to push out families who exceeded the reduced income limits. "Be proud to move out, so that a lower-income family can have the advantage that you have had," Elizabeth Wood told better-off families during their evictions. But the agency had difficulty finding other white tenants to replace those leaving the Cabrini row houses. The CHA had upped the quota of black residents allowed at the low-rise development, though only slightly, and it submitted to the demands of other occupants and kept sections of the row houses solidly white. Wood even had the agency print up tens of thousands of applications for the Cabrini row houses and distribute them among potential white residents. Brochures featured white children playing in yards and on the swings outside low-rise apartments, a picture of suburban comforts at inner-city public housing costs. But the efforts weren't enough. Whites made up less than half the row house population by the early 50s. Units sat empty, while hundreds of black families who had passed the CHA's screening weren't considered for them. Amid a citywide housing shortage, Wood and Taylor found themselves defending a quota system that seemed unethical, if also necessary. Wood believed, not inaccurately, that there was a racial tipping point at which whites would view most inner-city public housing as an entitlement meant solely for Negroes. By the start of the 1960s, white families occupied only 42 of the nearly 600 units in the Cabrini row houses. The Butlers were eventually forced to leave their apartment in 1117 North Cleveland. Jerry and Curtis Mayfield formed a band with a couple of friends who'd made the journey to Chicago from Chattanooga, Tennessee. As the Roosters, they were performing at a talent show at Washburn Trade School when a promoter named Eddie Thomas heard them and promised he could make them into stars. Thomas explained that the group's name sounded too country. They settled on the Impressions. Always leave an impression. In 1958, they recorded their first song on the South Side's Record Row. Butler had written the tune a couple of years earlier when he was a teenager gazing out of his high-rise window, a kid pining for idealized love. It had no hook and no real sing-along parts. "A poem set to music," he'd say. "For Your Precious Love" reached number 11 on the Billboard charts. The Young Men played the Apollo Theater in New York, and Butler received a royalty check of a couple hundred dollars. The CHA soon contacted the mother of Jerry, the Iceman Butler, saying the family's joint income exceeded the maximum allowance for public housing. the Butlers moved to a house on the south side. Curtis Mayfield stayed on in the Cabrini Row houses for several more years, selling cigars and office buildings in the Loop before his own music career took off again, and he could afford an apartment of his own in a new high-end complex just 10 blocks away. When the Housing Act of 1937 was being debated, it was opposed by every real estate trade group, by builders, suppliers, U.S. chambers of commerce, property owners associations, and the Departments of Commerce and the Interior. 8 years earlier, the department store scion Marshall Field III opened one of Chicago's first subsidized housing developments a couple of blocks north of the future Cabrini Row House site. The Marshall Field Garden Apartments included 628 low-income dwellings, as well as a progressive demonstration school, workrooms, and storefronts on the ground floor. But the entire complex was privately funded. The charity intended also to attract additional commercial and residential development to the surrounding Italian neighborhood. State-run housing was seen as something altogether different. Critics of the day denounced it as government overreach, with the handouts maligned as anti-capitalist, socialist, and generally un-American. A public housing development, the very idea of it, clashed with the country's exalted sense of home ownership, with a national ethos wrapped up in visions of the frontiersman, the log cabin, and the self-made entrepreneur. Although the subsidy was reserved only for stable families with modest incomes, the deserving poor, the ceiling on what residents could earn was said to discourage hard work, acting as a sap on initiative and pluck. Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, from 1943, dramatized the backlash against Roosevelt's call for a deeper social contract of shared responsibility. The hero of the novel is an architect of a public housing complex who becomes outraged when he returns from a trip to discover that his bare-bones high-rise has been compromised to include the expense of incomprehensible features. Among what he deems non-essential aesthetics are blue-painted metal balconies. You gotta give him a place to sit on in the fresh air, he's told. A gymnasium demanded by the social worker in charge of tenant selection. Extra doorways and windows. An awning. Decorative brickwork. And a carved relief sculpture above the building's main entrance. In an act that is portrayed as a valiant defense of his convictions, the architect dynamites the entire building. Like all the New Deal programs, public housing wasn't positioned as a renunciation of the for-profit capitalist system. Instead, it was a massive government intervention meant to save it. Hiring under the Public Works Administration, relief for farmers, aid to senior citizens through Social Security, food stamps for the urban poor, and public housing. These reforms treated poverty not as a personal moral failing, but as a widespread social and economic injustice that the country was obligated to right. The programs were also intended to jumpstart the economy, creating jobs and resuscitating the industrial sector through large-scale civic construction projects. In 1949, Congress passed legislation that promised to fund 810,000 additional units of public housing. President Harry Truman, in signing the bill into law, declared that it was the nation's collective duty to provide a decent home and a suitable living environment for every American family. But it was voted into law only after being packaged as part of an expansive urban renewal bill that promised to revive cities and rebuild their infrastructure. In the House of Representatives, the last of several efforts to strip the bill of its public housing provisions came within 5 votes of passing. Catherine Bauer, the crusader who helped will the nation's public housing program into being, would regret that the entitlement was continuously controversial, not dead, but never more than half alive. The CHA, which campaigned to get 40,000 of the new public housing units built in Chicago, argued that modernizing the worst neighborhoods would not only benefit the poor, but also restore the city to profitability. A Chicago slum district costs the taxpayers 6 times as much annually as is paid back to the city in taxes, the agency advertised. The CHA estimated that it could build as many as 150,000 units of public housing without taking a single customer away from the standard private sector housing market. In a further appeal to self-interest, the agency added that quality low-rent homes would keep the poor from seeking better housing elsewhere, such as in your neighborhood. Maybe most tellingly, the same Depression-era legislation that funded the country's first public housing developments also created the federally insured private home loan. With a Federal Housing Administration guarantee, banks were able to offer large home mortgages to people, paid off in small increments over an unprecedented 30 years, allowing families to put down as little as 10% of a house's cost. With this revolution in home financing, families could afford bigger and better homes, and developers and designers began to build homes in anticipation of the growing demand. The subsidies to the speculative real estate market dwarfed the outlays to public housing and to any programs offering rental assistance. Here was the American dream in practice. A select number of the nation's ill-housed got public housing in cities. Those better off were able to buy homes, increasingly in the suburbs, with the government taking on the risk. African Americans, who'd been owned as property a little more than 2 generations earlier, and then had their own property systematically taken away from them in the Jim Crow South, found themselves excluded from a gamed mortgage system that allowed others to accumulate wealth with little investment and with minimized risk. The most virulent opposition to public housing in Chicago came from white working-class families who felt trapped in the racially changing city. With the flow of migrants from the South surging after the Second World War, realtors used shady blockbusting tactics, surreptitiously moving a single black family into an area, then drumming up fears among white neighbors of decreasing property values and a growing threat of crime, to buy up their houses on the cheap. Many white Chicagoans took advantage of the new federally insured mortgages to speed out to all white suburbs. Those who couldn't afford to move were desperate to preserve whatever tenuous hold they had on their neighborhoods. Their parents or grandparents had come to Chicago from Europe, and they'd made a home in the city, buying a bungalow among families much like themselves. They believed all of that was now in jeopardy. There were nearly 500 outbreaks of interracial violence in Chicago between 1945 and 1950, with 350 of them directly tied to fights over housing. At the CHA's airport homes near Midway Airport on the west side, white residents from the neighborhood vandalized the public housing development in 1946 at the mere rumor that black World War II veterans might be allowed to live there. Several men strong-armed their way into the housing office, stole keys, and moved white families into vacant units. When the CHA did rent one of the subsidized apartments to a black family weeks later, the husband was a decorated veteran, one of the 175,000 returning from the war who applied for government housing assistance in Chicago, and he was selected as carefully for the occasion as Jackie Robinson was for his integration of Major League Baseball the following spring. As a precaution, the CHA brought in the family during the day, when most men from the community were away at work. But white women took up the charge, hurling curses and dirt and bricks. Similar protests occurred the following summer when the CHA tried to integrate the Fernwood homes, except that the mobs in the South Side neighborhood of Roseland were even larger, reaching 5,000. White youth pulled black drivers from passing cars and beat them. Local churches and community groups endorsed the violence that continued for weeks, and the neighborhood's aldermen condemned not the perpetrators, but the CHA, for including Roseland in these ideological experiments. The largest of the city's public housing race riots occurred at the Trumbull homes, in the South Side neighborhood of South Deering, In 1953, a light-skinned black woman applied for a public housing unit in Chicago, and the housing authority, assuming she was white, accidentally integrated the development of three-story apartment buildings and row homes. South Deering was a working-class area of Italians, Poles, and Slavs, south of the encroaching Black Belt, but north of all-black Altgeld Gardens, separated from it by Lake Calumet and the surrounding steel mills. When the woman showed up with her husband and children, the resulting protests lasted for months, with locals setting off homemade bombs and crowds burning down businesses. A community newspaper wrote about the savage, lustful, immoral standards of the Southern Negro, submitting that South Deering might consider accepting black residents only after black people were civilized. In the meantime, the white neighborhood would defend itself, while other spineless communities were raped, robbed, and murdered. In 1947, amid the ongoing racial upheaval, the city's Democratic machine forced out Mayor Edward Kelly. Kelly had allowed Elizabeth Wood to keep the CHA free of the machine's patronage hires and preferential contracts, and he tolerated an agency agenda often at odds with the interests of local ward bosses. The new mayor, Martin Kennelly, was picked by the regular Democratic organization because he could be counted on by the city's power brokers. Some progressive housing reformers at that time believed it was preferable to build new public housing on vacant land on the outskirts of the city, where the net gain of homes would be greatest and the poor could start anew. Others insisted on building atop existing slums, so the city's most deplorable housing would be replaced. Elizabeth Wood and Robert Taylor wanted to spread around new sites, apportioning the working poor across a number of different neighborhoods so that the entire city shouldered the responsibility of housing the disadvantaged. But under Kennelly, the city council was given the final say on the selection of public housing sites. Spurred on by the racial fears of their constituents, aldermen rejected every site proposed by the CHA that was in a white neighborhood. When the council debated the issue for four consecutive days in 1950, hundreds of residents from white areas were bussed in to fill the gallery. Of the 12,500 new units to go up in Chicago, just 2,000 of them would be constructed on empty land. The remaining 10,500 were built in black slums, or as extensions of existing public housing developments. The CHA reluctantly accepted these terms. Any housing was deemed better than further delays or no new homes at all. From that point on, the agency no longer bothered to suggest sites for its developments beyond existing ghettos. Robert Taylor, humbled, resigned. And while Wood stayed on until 1954, when she was forced out, she had been stripped of her independence. "I was so undercut politically that I was feeble. I was floundering around," she said later. "We no longer had power to select where the projects were going to go, and we had very little space to work with, so we had to go to the high-rises." Of the 33 housing projects built in Chicago in the coming two decades, a total of 168 high-rise buildings, all save one, went up in an overwhelmingly black neighborhood, or an area far along in its transition from white to black. Public housing still represented a major upgrade for families in these decaying neighborhoods. Yet large public housing complexes now had the effect of solidifying the boundaries between black and white Chicago in superblocks, detached from the street grid and in towers of concrete and steel. In Arnold Hirsch's History of This Pivotal Reconfiguring of the City, The Making of the Second Ghetto, he calls the site selection of Chicago's high-rise public housing a domestic containment policy. Wood complained at a public forum soon after her firing, "It is the will of politicians to keep Negroes where they are." Dolores Wilson. Dolores always claimed she didn't want to take any additional responsibilities, that she preferred to be a spectator. But that just wasn't true. In her own subdued way, she'd end up running 6 different committees. She showed up for the PTA meetings at Jenner, her children's school, and found herself elected treasurer and later president. She served on her building council, planning activities for the teens and younger children in the tower. The tenants celebrated the birthdays of their high-rises at Cabrini, the date coinciding with their address, and Dolores helped throw a big party in the 1117 North Cleveland Rec Room every November 17th. She attended Holy Family Lutheran, a small cube of a church across the field from her apartment, joining its board, and started volunteering with an organization that helped the formerly incarcerated manage their return to free society. She spent many hours as well at the Lower North Center. Her children attended camp there and used it for dance and music classes and sports. The center hosted the parties of the local high schools, a parents group, and a social club that showed movies and took residents on fishing trips, and to a Shakespeare festival in Stratford, Ontario. Adults gathered there for acting lessons, Hawaiian-themed teas, and for lectures by visiting scholars. The African-American historian John Hope Franklin, an expert on slavery and Reconstruction, spoke to Cabrini residents about the 2-century struggle for freedom and equality. When Bobby Kennedy showed up at Cabrini in 1963 as part of his brother's presidential commission on juvenile delinquency, he walked the buildings and shot pool with teens at the Lower North Center. The feminine part of the staff agreed to keep the hand that the attorney general shook unwashed, noted the Northside Observer, a regular feature in the Chicago Defender that was written in the decorous style of a high society registrar. Dolores Wilson was present at many of the affairs chronicled in these pages. She helped out with everything from back-to-school giveaways to Christmas bazaars, raffles, and dances. She was a soloist in a musical extravaganza and was among the diligent volunteers of a PTA rummage sale, to whom the newspaper offered a low bow of gratitude for being on hand into the wee hours of the morning with the detested sorting. The Cabrini Extension high-rises were a low-income development of some 10,000 people, crammed together on isolated plazas set within a historic slum. There were bound to be issues. Shortly after the Wilsons moved in, drivers delivering milk among the 15 towers complained that teens were sneaking into their trucks and stealing bottles. In the enclosed stairwells and elevators, hidden from sight, children rode over the walls. Laundry machines were broken, and mailboxes bashed so they couldn't open. In one of the high-rises neighboring the Wilsons, 2 men on the 17th floor robbed another man of his television, and then, as a daily reported, shot him in the eye for no reason. On the corner of Division and Larrabee, on the northwestern edge of the complex, a mass of teenagers brawled. But Dolores felt like her 6th flat on the south side had experienced more disturbances than the entirety of her 19-story high-rise. And at Cabrini, she and her neighbors got together to try to deal with problems. They formed self-protection clubs and patrolled the laundry rooms, elevators, and corridors. Residents petitioned the housing authority to enforce rules, respond to maintenance calls, and support programs that engaged the large number of children living there. They started a law and order commission and demanded that the police carry out foot patrols and do something about the drunks from the taverns on Chicago Avenue and the roaming prostitutes from the warehouse district to the south. Saul Alinsky, the father of the Chicago style of community organizing, came to the auditorium at St. Philip Benizi School to advise a new tenant leadership group that called itself a Better Cabrini Organization. Alinsky told the Cabrini residents what they'd already realized from their experiences. They would have to show power in numbers if they hoped to exert influence over the CHA, the police, and City Hall. Mayor Richard J. Daley, his son will tell you, never aspired to have public housing high-rises built in Chicago. It's a big fallacy that he wanted all this. It's totally bullshit. He knew more about it than anyone else. He knew this would make them like a prison. Richard M. Daley, the mayor of Chicago from 1989 to 2011, has declared this many times when asked about the legacy of the city's public housing, his eyes fixed on the pages of a U.S. Senate hearing transcript from July 1959. The first Mayor Daley had gone to Washington that year to complain that the federal dollar limit allotted for each unit of public housing was prohibitively low, allowing only for the construction of densely packed towers. Daley explained to the senators his hope to make it not only high-risers, but also walk-up and row-houses. What the first Mayor Daley may have desired above all else was a bigger share of the federal kitty. But his son sees in the Senate hearing proof that his father has been remembered mistakenly as the creator of Chicago's public housing system. "This is not going to go well, as my father explained," the younger Daley clarified. "Of course, the federal government, always in their wisdom, goes ahead with it." It's true that Richard J. Daley took office after the city council voted to place new developments in existing black neighborhoods, after Elizabeth Wood was fired from the CHA, and after 15,000 of Chicago's 43,000 units of public housing were already built or under construction. At the ceremonial groundbreaking for the Cabrini Extension Towers, on April 23, 1955, Mayor Daley dug up several piles of dirt with a silver-painted shovel as photographers snapped his picture. A crowd of 1,000 onlookers broke through police lines in an attempt to shake his hand. It was one of Daley's first official acts as mayor, as he'd been sworn in only the previous day. Born in 1902, Daley grew up in a bungalow on the South Side neighborhood of Bridgeport, a mostly Irish community that included the Union Stockyards, which put 40,000 people to work dismembering and packaging most of the nation's meat. In the 19th century, the area had actually been called Hardscrabble, and the Irish immigrants who filled it took jobs digging the nearby Illinois and Michigan canals. Daley, as a teenager, was president of the Hamburg Athletic Club, a group of local toughs, boys from the same parish and operating out of the neighborhood ward office. Daley's youth organization was similar to other groups of teen boys found in many impoverished ethnic or migrant communities. They fought as sport, defended their blocks, and usually aged out of street violence as they took on new roles available to them. In Bridgeport, depending on one's abilities, that meant a job either on the disassembly lines of the stockyards, in municipal work, or in politics. Daley was a short, pugnacious man whose resting face was a tight-lipped scowl. He possessed neither an abundance of charisma nor eloquence, and his rise in the Cook County Democratic Organization was not meteoric. He held a series of positions within the rigid hierarchy of the party, showing fealty to superiors, but always lobbying to move up the ranks. He worked in the county treasurer's office and as a state representative, a state senator, the state director of revenue, and as county clerk. An intensely private man, robed in tailored suits, he proved hardworking and tough and honest. In 1953, he was named chairman of the Cook County Democratic Central Committee, second in command behind only Mayor Kennelly. Kennelly, summed up by the journalist A.J. Liebling as a bit player impersonating a benevolent mayor, had failed to quell racial unrest in several transitioning neighborhoods and made the great error of cutting back on patronage positions in favor of non-political civil servants. In the next election, the party put Daley's name, not Kennelly's, on the ballot. The city's famed Democratic machine, which controlled Chicago politics for 50 years, was the invention of Anton Cermak, who took over as mayor in 1931. Cermak would go on to operate it for only a brief time. 2 years into his mayoralty, while in Miami, he was greeting President-elect Franklin Roosevelt when an Italian immigrant, inflamed by a general disdain for the rich, fired several shots at FDR. The assassin missed his target, but managed to strike 5 bystanders, including Cermak, who later died from his wounds. I'm glad it was me instead of you, Sir Mac supposedly uttered to Roosevelt on the way to the hospital. The words later inscribed on his tomb in the Bohemian National Cemetery on Chicago's north side. Chicago under the machine was often called the city that works. But output and efficiency are at best byproducts of machine politics, which is fundamentally a maker of self-perpetuation. A ward boss doles out patronage jobs, and the secretaries, park attendants, and sanitation workers who owe their livelihoods to him raise money for the party, and come election time, they get out the vote for the entire slate of machine candidates. The ward, in turn, is rewarded with city services, investment, and additional jobs to dispense, while the party remains in control of the purse strings. Once in office, Daley wasted no time demonstrating how he would consolidate power over his next 21 years as mayor. At his inaugural, he announced that he was relieving city council members of their administrative and technical duties. Constituents had previously gone to their aldermen for everything from requesting a building permit to reporting a road in need of repaving. No longer. Now they would travel downtown to City Hall for a brief audience with the mayor in his fifth-floor office. Everyone in the city needed to know that they were indebted specifically to the man on five. "There can be no organizations within the organization," Daley famously pronounced. In his first 2 years as mayor, Daley increased the number of patronage jobs by 75%, and the number of exams administered for civil servants was cut by more than half. He oversaw a top-down system of leveraged loyalty and reciprocal favors. Daley believed in its virtue without apology. Once, when urging President Lyndon Johnson to appoint one of his Chicago guys as a U.S. attorney, Daley summed up his case by saying, "But more than that, Mr. President, let me say with great honor and pride, he's a precinct captain." Like other industrial cities along the Great Lakes, Chicago was swooning by the time Daley took office. "A jukebox running down in a deserted bar," Nelson Algren wrote of Chicago in the 50s. The population fell fast from its 1950 peak of 3.6 million. Businesses abandoned the city at about the same rate. Chicago lost more than 50,000 manufacturing jobs in the 7 years before Daley's first term. Daley's plan to save the city focused primarily on the central business district, and, under his administration, the city would build hundreds of new office towers, including the Prudential Building, McCormick Place, the Civic Center, and the Sears Tower. He presided over the creation of a revised zoning code that freed up where developers could build luxury residential high-rises. And even as people departed for the suburbs, Daley made it easier for them to travel back to the flagging city for business, commerce, and pleasure by constructing highways, the largest underground downtown parking system in the country, with 8,000 spaces, and underground walkways leading directly to office buildings and department stores. You could return to the changing inner city without ever having to be exposed to it. Daley might have argued for low-rise public housing before the Senate, but if high-risers were what was available, high-risers were what he would build. Millions of federal dollars were at stake, representing thousands of jobs and many big union contracts. As Chicago made upgrades to its centrally located communities, public housing also became a tool wielded to assist the developers involved in the rebuilding. Those displaced by government-funded urban renewal had to be relocated somewhere. They were moved into the new high-rise projects. Almost all these families were African American. Not for nothing was urban renewal referred to ruefully as Negro removal. Whites still made up 13% of the families in CHA properties, but they lived almost exclusively in low-rise developments and senior buildings. Daley had inherited a faulty public housing system, but he was responsible for doubling its size. With 43,000 units, Chicago became home to the second largest stock of public housing in the nation, well behind New York with 180,000 units, and technically behind Puerto Rico, too. Most of the new public housing went up on the south side, with densities greatly exceeding what the CHA had previously allowed. The Robert Taylor Homes, named almost ironically in honor of the agency's African-American chairman who pushed for integration, replaced a big chunk of the federal street slum and became the largest public housing complex in the world. Its 28 nearly identical 16-story towers stretched in groups of three along a narrow 95-acre band. The buildings would extend the State Street corridor of public housing from the Hilliard Homes, just south of the Loop, through the Harold Ix Homes, Dearborn Homes, Stateway Gardens, and on to Robert Taylor. It was a largely uninterrupted 4-mile wall of public housing, cut off from points west by the newly constructed 14-lane Dan Ryan Expressway. And in 1962, the city completed the William Green Homes, the last portion of what came to be known as Cabrini Green. The development was named for a longtime leader of the American Federation of Labor, who took over the union from Samuel Gompers. The AFL had been found guilty of illegally excluding blacks from the unions building the Cabrini row houses. The Green Homes consisted of 1,096 apartments in 8 exposed concrete towers of 15 and 16 stories spaced within a tidy triangle of land formed by Division Street and the point formed to the north by the intersection of 2 diagonal avenues, Clybourne and Ogden. The building's concrete frames and precast concrete sectionals were of the same sandy beige color, and the towers looked like giant computer punch cards. They came to be known as the Whites, in contrast to the Reds across Division Street to the south. Including the row houses and its 23 high-rises, Cabrini Green now consisted of 3,600 units of public housing, all of it on a total of just 70 acres of land. Dolores Wilson. When Hubert Wilson was assigned the graveyard janitorial shift for the Red Cabrini Extension high-rises, Dolores decided she'd take a job during the day. She worked on and off at the Spiegel Catalog Company, sending out letters to people who hadn't paid their bills. She had a position as a receptionist for a doctor, as a clerk at a cleaner's, and for a while at the Department of Veterans Affairs Employment Center. Just as her mother had done on the South Side, Dolores started going door to door for the local precinct captain, traveling up and down her high-rise, talking to every tenant, telling them when to vote and whom to vote for. When the ward organization held its big raffle, she sold tickets, coming out of pocket for any of the ones she couldn't foist on others. It was no small expense. "But that's the way it is," Dolores would say. "It isn't what you know, it's who you know." She was right. The precinct captain came to rely on Dolores, and when a bundle of patronage jobs was being divvied up, he raised her name. In 1966, she started at the city's Department of Water Management, just a few blocks east in the Chicago Avenue pumping stations, across Michigan Avenue from the old Chicago Water Tower. She was the only black person there, in an office that handled paychecks for the entire department. Many nights, she'd hustle back to Cabrini Green from the water department, cook dinner for the children, help them with homework, and then rush out again for a meeting at Holy Family or Jenner Elementary or the Lower North Center. In addition to his janitorial work, Hubert also coached a basketball and a baseball team that their sons joined. When they lived on the South Side, Hubert had been in the National Guard, and at Cabrini Green, he started a drum and bugle corps that he named the Corsairs. 3 other janitors helped him. 2 were named Brown, and for their different complexions, Dolores called them Red Brown and Black Brown, though not to their faces. The men went to Montgomery Ward to get the fabric to make the Corsairs' pirate uniforms. Neither the Wilson children nor many of the other boys and girls in the Corsairs could read music, but they learned the beat and picked up the songs easy enough. The boys who didn't play instruments turned mock rifles in lockstep, and the girls twirled batons and flags as majorettes. They practiced in the field outside 1117 North Cleveland and the other surrounding towers, people looking down on them from 100 different ramps or watching from in front of the buildings. Soon the Cabrini-Green Corsairs were traveling to suburbs outside Chicago, marching in parades for St. Patrick's Day and Memorial Day, and winning trophies at competitions. Occasionally, amid their work jobs and their volunteer jobs and all that parenting entailed, Dolores and Hubert found time to go out together. Sometimes they just sat outside in the park beside the high-rises, laughing and talking. "It was beautiful out there," Dolores would say. "Green grass everywhere, flowers, no blacktop or broken glass." Hubert loved jazz, and he'd invite people over to the apartment to listen to records. But the two of them also went out with the other janitors and their wives. South of them, behind Montgomery Ward, was a ghost town of warehouses come night. But there were some clubs on Chicago Avenue that they frequented. Dolores favored the Chicago Lounge. It wasn't fancy, but the people there treated them like regulars, remembering their names and what they drank. The DJ spun records Dolores wanted to hear. If someone asked her to dance, she'd have to get Hubert's permission. "He was jealous, jealous, jealous," she would say. "That man wouldn't believe a black cow gave white milk." She didn't give him anything to worry about. She was ever faithful. But if they were apart for 10 minutes, he'd ask where she'd been and with whom. They'd argue some nights over these petty exchanges, but come morning, they never parted without an apology, trading kisses and saying, "I love you." Dolores had been a teenager when they married, and the two of them still walked the land at Cabrini Green holding hands. At the Chicago Lounge, Hubert would look over the guy who wanted a dance, sizing him up and say, "Yeah, go on, baby." It wasn't close dancing. It was jitterbugging, the bop, the chicken. "But heaven forbid that guy asked me for a second dance," Dolores remembered. 3. Catch as Catch Can. Kelvin Cannon. On the western edge of Cabrini Green, in the industrial wilds between the river and the high-rises, somewhere within the dumping grounds beneath an elevated roadway, an old witch was said to make her home. Kelvin Cannon had heard the story 1,000 times. His mother told it to him at bedtime. His relatives and friends' mothers repeated it. His teacher cited it as warning. The witch roamed the hills under the Ogden Avenue Bridge, just beyond the whites of the William Green homes. Any little boy or girl caught outside after dark, the witch would snatch up. Kelvin had even seen a sketch of her pinned to the bulletin board at the YMCA, like a wanted poster. A gypsy lady, with colorless skin, long matted hair, and flowing robes of rags. Kelvin's family was living in 534 West Division, one of the new white high-rises, when he was born in 1963. His parents had moved there from the west side, and before that, from a river town in Mississippi. Kelvin had convulsions as an infant, and from a young age he believed himself in possession of uncommon powers of perception. He figured the tale of the witch had to be far-fetched. The more he considered it, the more he understood that adults probably put the story out there to keep children like him out of harm's way. The barrens under the Ogden overpass were nowhere safe. You'd find broken-down cars there, machine parts, cracked bits of road, and makeshift tents of cardboard and wood in which vagrants sometimes slept. His mother and teachers could just as well have said a big brown bear lived down there. Yet Kelvin had friends who swore they'd seen the witch. From the upper floors of their high-rises, these children pointed out their windows at the bridge directly below. "Right there! That moving shadow, that's her!" One boy starting his paper route in the pre-dawn gloom was startled when a figure zipped past him. He watched, unable to move, as the white blur